This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. The image of an elderly couple holding hands on the beach can conjure all kinds of romantic notions. How long have they been together, and how have they kept their marriage strong? What we may not think about is their level of intimacy. Cultural representations of sex and sexuality usually feature images of younger, firmer bodies. But in fact, research shows that many seniors can and do have active sex lives, and it's not all about the sex. Dating and romance don't have shelf lives either. Today on our series Embodied, we're talking about aging and intimacy. We'll talk with a divorced woman in her 60s who took on internet dating, a man in his 70s who's married to a much younger guy, but we start in our 50s with a guest who's negotiating menopause. Omishade Bernice Scott is the creator of the podcast The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, and she joins us today on The State of Things. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So, I want to remind people that they can join our conversation today by tweeting at us with the hashtag embodied. So tell us what your experience has been like in your physical body during this period of menopause.
Yeah, I remember I turned 52 years ago, and I have two sons, one 27 and one 10. And my 10-year-old, then at 8, said to me, "You know, you're a half century old." And I said, "This is true." You know, so looking at your body, inhabiting your body, there's so many things that are happening. I feel like this is like a second puberty. I remember all of the anticipation when I was 12 to getting my first cycle, to having enough breasts to actually wear a bra. It was so much. And there were all kinds of conversations. Everybody was constantly talking to you about, this is what you should prepare for. This is so exciting. Are you ready? Like we read, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, like all the time. And when I started in perimenopausal kind of phase of life, no one was having conversations with me. And unfortunately, at that time, my mother was already deceased. And so I couldn't like tap into her and say, "Hey, mommy, I'm pregnant and I'm 41. And I'm also like going through some other things. Is this what I should expect?" Right. And so here I am now, 52. And I still want to have those conversations around this kind of, I don't know, mix of self-consciousness and self-awareness.
So you want to have these conversations because it's something you feel like that isn't being talked about and you're experiencing something so specific in your body that you haven't before. Mm-hmm. Can you walk us through what's actually happening in your physical body, how it feels, what you've noticed?
Well, I say for me, and this is specifically for me because there's no kind of like homogeneity around what people are experiencing in terms of menopause because we're all different and wired differently. For me, my experiences have been around weight fluctuation. I have four different sizes in my closet. Not pleased about that. And I can, at any given time, like, this is the day I can wear these jeans. This is the day where those jeans are like, "Not today, darling. It's not going to happen." Sleeplessness has been a thing. I feel like insomnia is actually my girlfriend. She sits on the side of my bed at 3 o'clock in the morning and goes, "Hey, remember all that stuff you were supposed to do today that you didn't get done? Let's talk about it." Right? She's a constant companion. I also feel like I'm already an emotional, passionate person. And my experience with menopause is like that's been heightened, where I can listen to a song in the car and then I just burst into tears. Or if I see something really sweet or I see a kid, I'm like, "Oh, they're so sweet." And then I burst into tears. I also am experiencing anger. And anger is not something that I feel that I can be honest about experiencing, especially given the stereotypes and tropes about angry Black women. It's very hard for me to negotiate publicly when I feel angry. And so I need safe and sacred spaces where I can express that anger and not feel judged.
It's interesting because there are certain stories about our bodies that we associate with various periods of our life. And I think puberty, we say, "Oh, we are changing. Our bodies are supposed to change." But it seems like there's almost this story that you've inherited that your body shouldn't be changing anymore. And it is. And that is challenging to deal with.
I think it's so it's societal and it's also cultural, right? So your body's changing, and change is a shameful thing because it's associated with aging. Right. So we live in a society that values youthfulness, thinness, whiteness, straightness. Black women are definitely not on the top of the list of things that people would consider valuable. So when you are going through changes where your hair looks different, your body looks different, your emotions are different, it's a very hard thing to negotiate in a public space because you're already battling against stereotypes and tropes.
You are trying to start conversations with other women, and you've had a number of them so far. Mm-hmm. What are the most profound things that you've heard about how women are navigating this changing period of their body?
Yeah, so I started the podcast out of a need to have conversations with folk just to kind of ground truth my experience. I didn't want to think that I was the only person going through these things. And so I reached out to folk who were in my peer group. But I also wanted to talk to older Black women, like who were significantly older than me, 20, 30 years older than me. And the first thing that struck me was the resounding enthusiasm to have the conversation. I was like, hey, you want to talk about menopause? They're like, oh my God, yes. I'm like, really? Okay, great. He's like, do you want to talk about sex? They were like, oh, yes. Do you want to talk about intimacy and romance and change and risk? And they were like, yes, yes, yes. And so I think the invitation to the conversation was first for me a very selfish place. I needed it. And then the response that I got from folk like Jackie Shelton Green and Lana Garland and Mama Nia, who works with Spirit House, the emphatic yes was like, oh, this is a thing. This is not just what Omi's experiencing. This is actually a cultural experience that is kind of cloistered and kept away from folk.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now. Dr. Karen Clark is with us. She's an OBGYN at Chapel Hill Gynecology and a certified menopause practitioner. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Omi gave us a bit of a sense of what her personal experience has been of the symptoms of menopause. Can you describe to us from a scientific perspective what is happening in the body during menopause?
Well, menopause in many ways is the opposite of puberty. You know, when women are young, the first thing they develop is testosterone because that's the substance of the ovaries. Afterwards, the eggs begin to make estrogen, and subsequent to that, after ovulation, they begin to make progesterone. At the other end of the age spectrum, the capacity that the ovary loses first is the ability to ovulate. So you don't make much progesterone anymore, or if you do, you make it sporadically. Then after that, the estrogen begins to go away, and then finally you're left with testosterone, although not as much as you had when you were younger. So that's pretty much what goes on. And
what does that mean in terms of symptoms, both the most common kinds of symptoms and maybe the less common?
Well, the ones we talk about the most are the hot flashes and night sweats. Those are the characteristic things that people associate with menopause, but there are many other symptoms associated with menopause too. There can be weight gain, anxiety, palpitations, brain fog, change in body shape, change in libido, many things.
And some of these things are things that can be conflated with other things that people have going on, which is why it's unique to have a provider who is particularly experienced in treating women with menopause. Can you tell us about some of the things that you're able to do as a provider that you wish other providers were aware of in terms of the specificity of menopause?
Well, it all begins with taking a good history from the patient. The patient has to tell you her story. And it's always been true that if you let a patient talk long enough, they'll give you the diagnosis. You know, so you listen, you take notes, you try to put things in perspective, considering the patient against her whole lifespan and her whole social network, and try to discern what's going on. Sometimes it's obviously hormonal. Sometimes it's obviously something else like depression or ADD. Some women come in thinking that the depression is going to be healed with estrogen. They want to test estrogen levels and testosterone levels, but for many people, depression is depression. And you have to be able to guide the patient on the right path where she'll feel the best.
So talk about some of the treatment options that are available to people who are experiencing maybe more severe symptoms.
Well, I always start with traditional Chinese medicine using herbs and acupuncture. You can't just do acupuncture. The herbs and the acupuncture together work very well. And I have several traditional Chinese medicine practitioners that I refer patients to. You can use something like black cohosh, which you may have seen as the brand name Remifemin. It's an American Indian herb that's been used for a long time for alleviation of vasomotor symptoms, and that's the hot flashes and night sweats. That works well for a lot of people, and for a lot of people it doesn't. There are things like antidepressants. The one I'm thinking of in particular is called Brizdel, which is essentially an ultra low dose of Paxil, the antidepressant. So the Brizdel is not FDA approved for treating depression, just for hot flashes and night sweats. And some women do very well with that. or another antidepressant called Effexor. Another option would be to use a low-dose birth control pill, and that's appropriate at some points in the perimenopausal transition. I tell people it serves as a big Band-Aid to put over the whole situation, and very often that's all that they need, but some people need hormone therapy.
And I want to talk more about hormone therapy when our conversation continues in just a minute. I'm with Dr. Karen Clark. She's a Chapel Hill-based OBGYN and certified menopause practitioner. Also with us is Omishade Bernie Scott, the creator of The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause. They'll both stay with us as we continue our conversation just ahead. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, our broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. As part of our series Embodied, we're talking about aging today and how it impacts relationships and intimacy. The beginning of one big change for women is menopause. The hot flashes, mood swings, fatigue, and weight gain can all be signals a woman's reproductive years are coming to an end. We're talking to Dr. Karen Clark, an OBGYN at Chapel Hill Gynecology and a certified menopause practitioner. Omishade Bernie Scott is also with us. She's the creator of The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause. So, Dr. Clark, we were speaking briefly about one of the common treatments, which is administration of estrogen. And it has a bit of a controversial history because of a study that came out in 2002. Can you tell us briefly about that study and the impact that it had?
Yes, the Women's Health Initiative study was reported out initially in 2002. The study was halted early because of a finding of increased breast cancer among the women who were using the particular hormone therapy that was used at the time. So all of a sudden, physicians started taking their patients off of hormone therapy. Many women, fearing the inception of breast cancer, stopped using their hormone therapy as well. There was a period of time after that where women who had not been suffering because they had been using their hormone therapy began to suffer. In fact, there was a movie that came out about that called Hot Flash Havoc. And with time, there has been reanalysis of some subsegments of the Women's Health Initiative study. Subgroup analysis revealed that women who started hormone therapy in the proper window of time, which extends about 10 years after the final menstrual period, those women have a reduced risk of heart attack, stroke, osteoporosis, colon cancer, and maybe even Alzheimer's disease. The window of opportunity has sort of been traditionally considered to be closed after about 10 years because the incidence of heart disease and the early atherosclerotic lesions that can occur that lead to coronary artery disease have taken place by and large by about 10, 15 years after the last menstrual period.
So this therapy can be useful, and there has been kind of some misinformation that's been spread by the media about hormone therapy causing problems.
Right. And when you look at the hormone therapy that was used in the study, they used conjugated equine estrogens, so that's horse estrogens, and medroxyprogesterone acetate, which is a synthetic progestin. It's a bad synthetic progestin, but it's all they had for the longest period of time, so that's what was used. Now we have biologically identical estradiol and progesterone and testosterone that can be used. These are things that women make.
So there are opportunities for women. Omishade, before we turn the conversation, we've talked about symptoms, many of which may appear negative, but there's also stuff to celebrate about mm-hmm. this period of our lives. Can you talk briefly about what you're celebrating about your own changing body right now?
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to kind of excavate the stories that exist outside of scientific data and the algorithms. I'm glad you're going to have somebody talk about the algorithms because Black women die on dating algorithms. But there's a lot of joy in kind of like really owning your journey. Right. And really owning the fact that you're the expert of your own body and the expert of your own experience. And so I did a lot of work around reproductive justice, and we talked about bodily autonomy all the time. And bodily autonomy seemed to be couched in the idea that women or femmes are able to have the authority to make decisions around when and if they'll become pregnant and under what conditions and, all the things around sex positivity. And those things exist for me as well right now. They exist for women over 50. They exist for Black women. They exist for Black trans women. They exist for Black femmes. And the joy that I'm experiencing is the encountering of that truth repeatedly by the conversations that I'm having with women who are a part of this podcast.
Omishade Bernie-Scott, the creator of The Black Girl's Guide to Surviving Menopause, and Dr. Karen Clark, an OBGYN at Chapel Hill Gynecology and a certified menopause practitioner. Thanks so much to both of you.
Mm-hmm, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Joining the conversation now is Ellen Ashley. She's a Greensboro resident who was married for 25 years and is now divorced. Instead of settling for the single life, Ellen joined Match.com and got active with meetup groups. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad
to
be here.
So we're moving into our 60s now, and we would love to hear a bit of your story. Tell us about the end of your marriage and some of the factors that led you to getting a divorce.
Well, it was a great marriage for a lot of years, and then things change over time. People's emotions change, their physical changes that you really can't control sometimes. So this marriage had been sort of losing intimacy really over the last 10 years of it. So when I left that marriage, I was so ready again for intimacy and ready to go have fun again and do things I love to do and have somebody with me who loved doing them with me. And we just found at that point in our life we were mismatched, and so I was ready.
What were some of your fears as you left that relationship as a woman who was now 60?
I guess the biggest thing was when you are coming out of a marriage when there was very little intimacy, I didn't feel beautiful or desirable anymore. And so dating was scary because, well, for so many reasons. I hadn't been dating for 26 years or more. And the good news is I had girlfriends who were single and had been dating a long time, and they were telling me about all the dating sites and ways, new ways to meet people. And so as soon as I was single, I immediately, I guess for the last year and 9 months, was on dating sites, and I was on Match, and I tried Tinder, and I tried OkCupid. And so, you know, Tinder is the scary one for everybody because they say it's a hookup site. And of course, my friend Judy in Boston, who is in the Northeast, she says, oh my gosh, that's the best one, but it's not a hookup site. But honestly, there, you know, you put no personal information into Tinder except a photo pretty much. So yeah, it's a hookup site pretty much.
Well, what was it like to build a profile of yourself as someone who hadn't been in the dating world for 20 some years to now kind of create this online persona for other people to see? What was that like for you?
It was a challenge. You know, I redid my profile several times. I found that you really do need professional photos. And because the first thing, especially for guys, sorry, but I mean, they're very visually oriented. They don't really care if you're the best cook, the best dancer, that, you know, all this. You know, if you don't look good to them, they're not even going to reply to you on a match dating site. So photos are very important. What I did find was that at least Match and OkCupid walk you through a lot of questions so that you know. So that you know kind of what people look for. They want to know if you've got kids, if you're retired yet, or what kind of hobbies you have. Are you politically liberal or conservative and so forth? So you get a pretty good profile just filling out those questions. And the cool thing I liked about OkCupid is that they actually have loads of questions that you can answer or not answer, but they're great questions for when you actually meet someone and are dating, because dating is like an interview. I mean, it's a very polite, fun interview, but you really have to know if you're getting together with somebody whose family doesn't get along, or if there's alcohol, if their mother was an alcoholic or whatever. And so those are great questions for the first dates.
So you hadn't experienced intimacy or sexual intimacy, I guess, in a particular way for a long time. What was it like to renegotiate that once you were out in the dating world again?
It was a huge challenge. physically, I went to my gynecologist and said, I need help just physically getting things working again, you know, because, you know, your body atrophies when you don't exercise. Well, guess what? Your other parts of your body atrophy too. So there was that, yeah. And then you were really careful who you were meeting up with, because if you weren't with a very, very considerate man or woman, you know, that it wasn't going to be fun for you anyway, you know?
And as a marriage ends, you're obviously, you were interested in dating again and rebuilding that part of your life, but you also spent a lot of energy rebuilding other parts of your life and other friendships and other kind of intimate bonds. Can you talk a bit about that and what your experience has been in kind of expanding the range of relationships that you have?
Yes, absolutely. Well, one thing you find when you're married, the people you hang out with are all married too. And when they have a dinner party, it's all couples if you're married. And when you're suddenly single, I found that people weren't, my married friends weren't like inviting me to dinner parties anymore, right? So I was finding out how to be single again. And I discovered meetup groups, which are absolutely wonderful. I mean, it's an online app, Meetup, and there are meetups for people over 40 and people over 50. And there's in Greensboro, there's the Triad hiking and kayaking group, and there are book groups, and there are wine lover groups and everything. And so I joined a couple of these and found that they were so welcoming. Not everybody was single, but by far 95%, I would say, are. And so it was cool when they would have an event to go to, like, an evening of music. You know, you could just, check the box, said, yes, I'm going too. And when you show up, your people are there. Right. So you don't feel like alone, even though you're going out alone. You're not alone when you get there. And it was so wonderful to have that. So it really filled that social void in my life at the time. And it still does.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now, sociologist and sexologist Pepper Schwartz. She's the author of numerous books on relationships and a professor of sociology at the University of Washington. She's also a relationship expert on the Lifetime reality series Married at First Sight. Pepper, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So as you've heard Ellen allude to, there's a lot of fear as people age about not being wanted, about how their changing body may impact their ability to create and sustain relationship. Can you talk about some of the cultural myths about aging bodies and the kind of impact that this can have on our ability to forge and develop new relationships?
Well, the biggest cultural myth is that it's not acceptable, it's not exciting, it doesn't work well as you age, and somehow you should pack it up at age 60 and, concentrate on being somebody's grandmother or somebody's knitting partner. And that's pretty much the way previous generations conceived of it. But it's changed, particularly in the baby boom generation, which has sort of been leading the charge of, I would call, constructive narcissism, which is to say, love yourself and treat yourself as somebody lovable, and figure it out about how you want to be in the world. But the world fights back. The world gives you only pictures of, 15-year-olds who are supposed to be 25-year-olds and 25-year-olds who are supposed to be 40-year-olds in the pictures and in the movies. And so, in a sense, we have to create new meaning and new vision in the way the baby boomers have done, all through their lives. It's hard because, as much as we can ideologically believe that, beauty is variable and all kinds of beauty can make us desirable, we have to go against years of how the society sees it. And it's tough to love yourself that way, but it's not impossible, and people do.
So there's this interesting study that came out in 2018 that I know you've spoken about before about online dating, and it concluded that while men's sexual desirability peaks at age 50, women starts high at 18 and falls from there. So can you talk about this statistic and maybe from your work on the algorithm design side of things on the online dating world, what you've learned about what older folks are looking for when they're online and how that's shaped by some of these statistics?
Well, first of all, dump those statistics because, somebody answered that on some kind of questionnaire, or they have other studies where they look at pictures, and yes, you're going to look at all kinds of features differently when you're just going picture after picture, but or question after question. But if you're in with persons, real people, then it becomes highly variable about how exciting and desirable you are. I know plenty of people who have the right mix of things that they need to present themselves, and they stay desirable into their 90s. I have lots and lots of anecdotes like that. So I really feel like you could depress the hell out of yourself if you just think that these things are stuck in concrete and that you have no power over them. I really believe, and I have seen it proven, and fortune, as you said, I've created an algorithm for one dating site, and I met my husband on another one. It's a question of, do you know how to do this new form of dating, and do you have the guts and the belief in yourself that you can, in fact, beat whatever odds there are about demographics, because, of course, the demographics are dating, particularly as you get older, are heavily in favor of men because they don't live as long. But the fact is that you just need one, and you just need to believe in yourself, and you just need to not defeat yourself before somebody else has even judged you, which is the big problem in online dating. I just literally the other day was sort of a wing woman to a friend of mine to get online. She's been coming out of a long marriage, and she, too, is nervous and feels, you know, like she's not, you know, what she used to be, et cetera. We just worked through that, and by the end of it, she was good to go, and I think she'll write a much better profile, a much better approach. But, you know, what I think it is there's a lack of one of your earlier commentators eloquently put about how everybody prepares you for puberty, but not for your aging body and your aging self. I really think that that's what we need. We need a lot more coaching about how to do this because it's doable, but we need help, and we don't get any help. It's one of the other ways that society offloads its older people, as if, well, if you're not going to be fertile, we're just not going to be interested in you.
Well, talk about ageism and how that plays into the conversation about relationship building and maybe more specifically sexual intimacy. There are a lot of myths about how people express themselves sexually as they age, and I know you've looked a lot into that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, ageism shows up even in people who don't believe they have it or don't believe they reinforce it. It's the belief that somehow someone is going to be less active, less passionate, less desirable, less desiring, less everything when they're older. And I had a dinner party the other day, well, actually, it was last winter, and a friend of mine was with a friend of mine who was in their 90s and had found a guy in her 80s to be involved with. And this friend of mine, who's pretty brusque, said, "Do you guys have sex?" And the woman in her 90s looked at my friend and said, "Of course." Now, I don't know what the realities here are, but what does sex mean? Does it necessarily mean that you've got some kind of two-hour marathon? Not that many people get that when they're 25, much less when they're 85. But does it mean that people can, in fact, figure out ways to sexually please each other, have orgasms, feel sexually fulfilled all the way through the life cycle? Yes, they can. Can they necessarily do it the way they did it 50 years ago? No. But if they ageism doesn't stop them from being innovative, if they don't feel defeated because they don't have hard enough erections or they need artificial lubricant, et cetera, if they don't let that stop them, then there's no reason they can't continue on throughout the life cycle being fully sexual and intimate people. But, as I say, what I feel is people defeat themselves more than they should because they don't even feel entitled. They don't feel worthy. They don't feel attractive enough. They don't feel like they can demand satisfaction out of life. And that's what ageism does to us, and that's what we have to defeat.
Ellen, I know you are in a new relationship now. Can you tell us maybe about any of the stories that you've had to rewrite for yourself about this next phase of life in order to fully lean into this new relationship?
Sure. And by the way, it's been a great experience for me the last year and 9 months or so that I've been dating. But, you know, I dated a lot before I met this new gentleman who is absolutely wonderful. I met him about 6 months ago. But before I met him, close your ears, Barrett, 35 people face to face. That's after I'd kind of screened them online and like eliminated several or many, and then but met face to face 35. Now, there were a lot of one dates, right? But I kind of decided with a friend of mine, she would say, "Well, Ellen, maybe you don't need one. I like the portfolio approach. You have one for dancing and with, and one to go to the movies with, and one you sit and actually talk to over dinner." And so I had kind of almost given up hope of finding one, and I was becoming more and more happy just going out and being with my meetup group and dating occasionally and stuff. And then I met this gentleman, and he is As a girlfriend says, Ellen, you could not have designed a better man. We have so much in common. We have, he's learning to dance with me. He joined my jazzercise group. He cuts my grass. I'll get out of the shower when he comes over and he's cutting my grass while I'm getting ready. I mean, I am telling you that life can be fabulous in the 60s. And if you need more encouragement, my mother, who is now 93, told me a year ago, and she is, you know, has two husbands who are deceased now, but she assured me that desire does not end at 90.
Ellen Ashley, a 62-year-old Greensboro woman. Thank you so much, Ellen, for talking with us. Also with us, Pepper Schwartz, professor of sociology at the University of Washington. She'll stay with us as we continue our conversation ahead on the state of things. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stachow. As part of our new series, Embodied, we're talking about aging and intimacy, delving into the fears, myths, and reality of what happens to our sexuality and relationships as we get older. Still with me is Pepper Schwartz. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Washington. Joining the conversation now is a couple, 72-year-old J.R. and 52-year-old Jonathan. The two met more than two decades ago in a chat room on AOL. Initially, it was nothing more than fun, but the couple has maintained a strong relationship for 18 years and recently got married. J.R. Dreyer, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi, thank you.
And Jonathan Cutler, thanks so much for being with us as well.
Glad to be here today.
So, J.R., tell us the story of how you two met.
Well, we met on a chat room on AOL, and for the longest time, actually, we chatted, but we procrastinated in meeting because, frankly, parking wasn't very easy where Jonathan lived, and it wasn't easy to get to my place. But eventually we did, and then for another couple of years, we just met very casually. Until one night, one day, he asked me out on a date. And we went to the movies, and we just had such a great time. The rest just started moving along really well.
Jonathan, there's a 15-year age difference between the two of you. Can you talk about how you've negotiated that age difference in your relationship?
Well, that's an interesting question because really didn't think about the age difference very much. I thought that J.R. was exciting and thoughtful, and I liked his persona, and I just found him to be a young spirit. So I really was less concerned with the age issue when we met. I guess as we're getting older, it is, I guess, more of an issue because he's 72 and I'm 57. Initially, it really was not a concern of mine.
Well, J.R.,
if I could add on to that, I do remember, Jonathan, at one point you did express some concern about being seen as a trophy bride. But we both got a laugh out of. I don't think that was a problem.
Well, J.R., I mean, for you as someone who is in his 70s, how has your aging body affected your confidence or self-image, if it has at all?
Well, yeah, I mean, my confidence, I realize who I am, and I know that that we all have gifts at different ages, and I have a lot of knowledge and experience, and that have added value to the person that I am. And physically, I go to the gym and see a trainer, and we're both very seriously invested in staying healthy, both through exercise and diet and rest, and reducing or addressing any causes of stress and tension. And those keep us going, keep me going, and Jonathan, too.
Joining, I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. This is Linda Waite. She has been studying intimacy and aging in couples for years. She's a professor in urban sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. Linda, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
So you have been studying couples aged in their 50s to their 80s through a huge national survey. Can you talk about some of the shifts that you have seen in how people experience various kinds of intimacy in their 60s, 70s, and 80s?
Sure. There are changes, and they're pretty clear. A lot of them have to do with the things that happen more often as people get older. And I'm thinking here of losing a partner to either very poor health or to death. So most adults, when we first look at them in their mid-50s, are partnered. And the people who are partnered are almost all sexually active. By the time we get to people in their 80s, most of the women are not partnered. And even among those with partners in their mid-80s, less than half are sexually active with a partner. So that's a big change. And it has to do with health and the way that people develop chronic conditions, some of which affect sexuality, and their social relationships.
Well, Pepper, you're the professor of sociology at the University of Washington, who's still with us on the line, Pepper Schwartz. I know you've looked at some interesting trends around sexuality and sexual fluidity, especially for women as they age into these older years. Could you talk briefly about that?
Well, I think women, as they age, get more and more into a female-centered society because, in fact, there is at least still a difference in longevity between men and women, and so that they perhaps do better than men in the sense that they have their social circle, for the most part, firmly established. And there's quite a bit of research that indicates the happiness of any individual is increased by dense social networks, not just having friends, but having quite a few of them, as opposed to offer different kinds of alternatives, and women maintain those better. Women's entree into affection and attraction and sometimes romance is through relationship for the most part. And so there is perhaps not statistically known, but certainly anecdotally represented, quite a few women who will open up the sexual fluidity that I think women own to some extent in larger proportion than men do, and become romantically involved with another woman or be in a relationship that is just about everything but. So in that sense, older ages for women are, I think, significantly different than for men.
Linda, obviously we've talked about a variety of kinds of intimacy in the course of this program, but I'm curious about this broader question of social health and this development of a network. What do you know about the strength of a network and the kind of impact that has on people's physical and mental health?
We actually know quite a bit, and I think it's very encouraging. We know that as with age, one of the things that happens is you lose people around you, or they change. They move away, they become too sick to do the things you used to do, or they die. And what we see in the National Social Life, Health, and Aging Project is that people seem to use a lot of agency to deal with these social challenges. So when people, we observed that people lost someone in their social network between the first time we interviewed them in 2005 and the second time in 2010, that on average, they added new people in and even ended up with networks that were a little bit bigger. So that's one way that people deal with the changes and the losses. They're very proactive. In addition, the way that people can be socially active changes, because if you, say, lose your partner or your partner becomes demented or you've been a long-term single, then you don't have that that social connection anymore. What we see is that as people get older, they turn more towards social connections that are under their control, like participating in groups, volunteering, being active in a religious organization. They can do more of that if they want to do more than that, and we see that they do.
So, Pepper, I wonder for you, I mean, there's a sense of risk-taking that people have to undergo to build these new relationships, to put themselves out there. And this is true at any phase of life, but I imagine it presents more challenges as you get older and there are less built-in social networks through work or, you know, parents of your kids, that kind of thing. What do you kind of recommend and suggest to people who feel like the risk-taking part of it is a big barrier and maybe online dating seems way too scary?
Well, I always think there's strength in community. So I think one of your guests early on talked about the meetup groups. Meetup groups where you know everybody is going pretty much for the same reason that you are. Whatever the interesting thing is, it is worth it just to, you know, hike or discuss movies or whatever it is. Those I think have, you know, a lower risk barrier. I do think online dating is a wonderful way to open up your world. But to have a wing woman or a wing man, somebody who will help you and make it fun and have humorous discussions about the ones the people you meet that, you know, maybe you wouldn't have wanted to meet, but provide a good story, or find someone you care about. I mean, I think always reaching out to friends, to join groups that you would enjoy being in anyhow. There's different social class issues here. Some people live in neighborhoods that are very supportive. Other people have the income and the ability to go and join some kind of assisted living or group living where, you know, new communities and new social issues are solved for them because a lot of them are planned by the community. But I think what it all boils down to is you really do have to have the agency to take care of your life and to see what's out there and find out what's emotionally and morally acceptable to yourself. It's harder in the sense that, you know, you're older, but it's better in the sense that you often know yourself better, feel a bit stronger about yourself. You are not in puberty anymore, and you do not have often the same lack of self-knowledge that you do when you're younger. So I think if you're willing to be an advocate for yourself, then you reach out to those people and those experiences that will help you do that.
Jaron, Jonathan, I want to turn back to you and talk about your 18-year relationship. And whenever we hear stories like this, people always want to know, what's your secret? How did you do it? How have you stayed together? And I want to know that. But I want to know if you can kind of articulate what has gotten easier and what's gotten harder as your relationship has grown and aged.
Well, this is JR. I think we would not be together if we hadn't gotten a significant amount of help, both professional help in developing our relationship and overcoming barriers, and also a lot of support from our families and friends, all of whom really liked our choice in partners. I think also in later years, recent years, the most important thing for us is that we realize we want to stay together, and we realize that in order to stay together, we want the other person to be happy. And there's a lot we can do and we can refrain from doing to help make that happen.
I agree with JR on that point. I think the biggest change is now my first question is, what can I do to make JR feel comfortable and fulfilled and full, even though these things may not be exactly to my liking.
Right. I'm going to have to let you go because there's some beeping because I think there's a phone that's dying. So thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully we can connect with you all again in the future. Linda, let me turn to you. As you've studied these couples whose relationships have changed and evolved over time, are there particular trends you've noticed in people who do stay together and the things that people do to keep these partnerships alive?
Yes. First of all, I said before that what we see is we look at people from their mid-50s to the mid-80s. The people in the mid-80s are less likely to have a partner, and even if they have a partner, they're less likely to be sexually active. But the people who remain sexually active are just as happy, and that's very happy with that partnership. And women who remain sexually active at through their mid-80s don't report any more problems with sexuality, like lubrication or lack of desire, than women like them who in their 50s. It seems like they're doing great. The ones who stop having sex or having more problems. For men, the only kind of sexual problem that seems to increase with age is erectile dysfunction. Everything else does not increase with age. So I think that that's one thing. People keep a sexual relationship with a partner as a priority, and that's one way to keep going.
Yeah,
the other thing is that
I'm going to have to pause you there because we only have about 30 seconds left, and I just want to give Pepper one more chance to talk. Pepper, if you could tell your 50-year-old self something, now you're in your 70s, that you would want her to know about these next few decades of her life, what would that be?
I'd just say be no less ambitious about your life from 50 on than you were till you reached 50.
Wonderful.
I mean ambitious in all ways, emotionally and in adventure and in accomplishment and in friendship.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. I wish we had more time. Pepper Schwartz is a professor of sociology at the University of Washington and a relationship specialist on Married at First Sight. Linda Waite is a professor in urban sociology and the chair of the Department of Sociology at the University of Chicago. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Fun to too.
And thanks again to J.R. Dreyer and Jonathan Cutler, who joined us via phone. You can find out more about all of our guests who we spoke to today at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Grant Hall of Mormon. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.